Avenue, make him stupid. After all, what was the whole wide world but a place for people to yearn for their hearts' impossible desires, for those desires to become entrenched in defiance of logic, plausibility, and even the passage of time, as eternal as polished marble. Chapter 18. At 6:05 on Sunday morning, a groggy Miles Roby came downstairs to prepare for the breakfast shift and found a man slumped over the counter, his forehead flat on the formica, as if it had been superglued there. It took a moment for Miles to recognize Buster, his fry cook, back from his annual heroic bender, which this year looked to have been damn near the death of him. He brought along a copy of the Sunday paper, and a fresh pot of coffee was steaming on the bun-o-matic, which suggested that Buster had not entirely forgotten his skills. Rather than wake him, Miles fired up the grill and filled its gleaming surface with bacon strips, about 3 pounds worth. When they started to sizzle, he took up the newspaper, the front page of which was devoted almost exclusively to Saturday's football game, with two photos of Zach Minty, a large one of him brandishing the fumble he'd recovered and a smaller one of him helping the woozy Fairhaven quarterback off the field. The boy had not returned for the second half after the late hit that temporarily knocked him out cold. He'd sat, dazed-looking, on the bench while Empire Falls chipped away at the score, a field goal here, a touchdown there, until the home team tied the game with a little over a minute to go. No surprise, the Empire Gazette saw the game in pretty much the same light as the hometown fans did, as a humiliating defeat for Fairhaven, which had led at the half by a score of 24-0. There was a surprise on the front page of the paper's lifestyle section. For the last several years, on Sundays, the Gazette had taken to running old photos of Empire Falls and its denizens during their glory days. The series was called The Way It Was. And earlier in the summer, they'd run a photo of the Empire Grill, circa 1960, with old Roger Sperry looking like he belonged on a lobster boat instead of behind a cash register, and a lunch counter full of working men extending into the background behind him, and the restaurant's grainy, shadowy booths full of customers. A sign on the back wall advertised a hamburg steak with grilled onions, mashed potatoes, a vegetable and roll for $1.25. One of the younger men pictured at the counter still came in and always sat on the same end stool if it was available. For reasons that mystified Miles, the series apparently had a cheering effect on the citizenry. People actually seemed to enjoy recalling that on a Saturday afternoon 40 years ago, Empire Avenue was bustling with people and cars and commerce, whereas now, of course, you could strafe it with automatic weapons and not harm a soul. Some characters in the Gazette photos were identified in the captions, but others became queries. Can you identify this man, this woman? Who were these people and what did they mean to us? The photo seemed to ask. Where have they gone? Why do we remain? The way it was always caused Miles to feel as if the town itself was awaiting some cataclysm that would finish them all off. Today's photo was of the old Empire Shirt Factory's office staff, taken in 1966, the year before the factory closed, and the only person in the second row not looking at the camera was a young and beautiful Grace Roby. Miles quickly checked the caption below, relieved to see that his mother was among the identified, because it would have broken his heart to see a "Does anyone know this woman?" affixed to her. Still, seeing his mother so unexpectedly gave Miles a sensation not unlike the one you'd have standing on railroad tracks and feeling or imagining the far-off trembling of something large racing your way. Not danger, exactly, unless for some inexplicable reason you were duty-bound to remain right where you were. Perhaps it was the fact that Grace was not looking at the camera, but rather off at an oblique angle that suggested she might have been listening to that same distant rumbling. If indeed it was an intimation of her own mortality she was hearing, Miles reflected, it had been closer than she thought. Not so long afterward, she was diagnosed. Within the year, at 43, she was dead. a year older, Miles noted, than he was now. Several others in the photograph were people Miles recognized, some dead, some living, some still residing in Empire Falls, others long gone. In one case, he thought it was a man he knew well, then realized it had to be the man's father. And at the end of the first row stood a small, white-bearded man dressed in a three-piece suit, C.B. Whiting himself, proprietor of the Empire Shirt Factory. If anything grim was bearing down on Mrs. Whiting's husband, he did not as yet seem aware of it. How many years after this photo was taken, Miles tried to remember, did he return from exile in Mexico and put the cold barrel of a revolver against his own pulsing temple? How strange, he thought, that just yesterday he'd stood at the foot of this man's grave. After the game, once the crowd had dispersed and they'd made their slow, careful way back to Miles's car, Cindy had asked if he'd be willing to take a short walk, and he'd made the mistake of agreeing before asking exactly what she had in mind. "I think it's the prettiest place in town," his companion said, as they followed the well-tended path. Cindy leaning more on her cane now than on Miles, though she did have a firm grip on his elbow, just in case. Losing her balance on the bleachers and pitching forward into Jimmy Minty's arms had unnerved her, but it didn't seem to be the fall itself that had upset her. That part she was used to. It was more like she'd imagined just such a scenario, but had envisioned falling romantically into Miles's arms, not Jimmy Minty's. At her suggestion, they'd parked just outside the east gate, the closest one to the Whiting section of the cemetery. Now, in the late afternoon, the sky had clouded over, and a chilly wind had come up, rustling brown leaves along the path. "It is peaceful," Miles admitted, sniffing the air. Was it his imagination, or was the breeze redolent of cat piss? Since entering the cemetery, Miles had seen several cats darting among the stones. Cemetery cats, Miles thought, recalling Cindy Whiting's term for her own beloved Timmy. They couldn't possibly be feral, could they? He didn't like to think what would offer them sustenance in a cemetery. The swelling where the Whiting cat had bitten him had gone down, but the hand began to pulse, inviting another round of scratching. This time, Miles decided to resist. A police cruiser rolled silently by on the other side of the cast-iron fence about 100 yards away, too far to make out whether Jimmy Minty was at the wheel. Cindy also tracked its progress until the cruiser turned onto Elm and headed back toward town. When they arrived at the top of the hill, the river was just visible in the distance, and a shaft of bright afternoon sun from a break in the clouds electrified the blue water. When they stopped before her father's grave, Cindy said, "He brings me here sometimes." Miles considered this statement. Knowing his companion's lifelong distaste for metaphor, he decided she was not claiming that C.B. Whiting drew her to this place by supernatural means. "Who?" he decided to ask.
"James."
No help.
"James? James Minty."
Now it was her turn to regard Miles dubiously, as if he were either slow or not paying close attention. He tried to think whether he'd ever heard anyone else call Minty James, then gave up. "I haven't been a very good friend, have I?" he confessed, hating to think that with respect to this poor woman he'd remained as stingy as an adult as he'd been as a boy. After all, how much time would it have taken him to bring her to visit her father's grave on her rare short visits to Empire Falls?
"Oh, Miles, you were married,"
she said, apparently reading his thoughts. There was a large pot of what had once been marigolds on C.B. Whiting's grave. They'd drooped and gone brown, the pot itself filling with brittle leaves. Here the smell of urine was even more pronounced than it had been before.
"I put these here just a few days ago," Cindy said, bending over precariously to examine the marigolds. "They should have lasted." She paused. "James works for my mother, you know. I'm sure she paid him for his time."
"Works for her how, exactly?" Miles asked.
"Different ways. He looks after the house when she travels. He helped her put in a security system. Keeps an eye on the old factories.
Miles nodded, suppressing a smile. If there was one person in Empire Falls he wouldn't want to know the intricacies of his security system, assuming he could afford one and had things worth stealing, that person was Jimmy Minty. But perhaps he was being unfair. It was possible Jimmy would be both grateful and loyal to anyone who treated him decently. And Miles realized, too, that he'd made a mistake, twice, in provoking him. A mistake it would be either humiliating or impossible to correct.
Actually, Cindy continued, she expects poor James to be on call.
Your mother expects everyone to be on call.
I won't tell her you said that, she said, taking his hand and giving it a squeeze.
You can if you like, he said cheerfully.
Dear Miles, she said, you're the only person she allows to talk back to her. Did you know that?
Not that it gets me anywhere.
She thinks of you as a son, you know.
He couldn't help chuckling at this. Yeah, a son she's always been disappointed by.
He was so unhappy here, Cindy said, as if this new remark flowed naturally from his. Letting go of his hand, she stepped closer to the monument and traced her father's engraved name with her index finger. Compared to the monuments marking the graves of the other Whiting males, CB's was the runt of the litter, though cut in the same style and basic shape as the other larger stones that mark the nearby graves of Honus and Elijah. Its being significantly smaller gave the impression that his stone alone had not grown after being planted, as if the corpses of his predecessors had already sucked all the nutrients out of the soil. The dead marigolds only furthered this impression. Mother says he was a weak man who never wanted to be a Whiting, but still enjoyed the money and privilege. Did you know he had a whole other family in Mexico?
No, I didn't.
In fact, he found it fairly shocking. After he died, Mother got a letter from the woman. She wanted money, of course, for herself and the little boy they had. She told my mother they'd been very happy, but I don't believe that. It was Mother who wouldn't allow him to come home.
Miles nodded, wondering if she'd come to this conclusion out of desperate need. As a boy, he'd often wondered why Max would disappear for months at a time, leaving him and his mother, and later his brother, to their own devices. So he assumed that Cindy Whiting had probably asked the same questions and perhaps even blamed herself, as Miles had. If she believed her father wanted to come home, it was probably because he told her so in Christmas and birthday cards. At the same time, it occurred to Miles that a man who'd built a hacienda in central Maine might find himself right at home in Mexico.
Did she ever say why?
She said he'd been a bad boy. Those were her exact words, she recalled bitterly. I used to beg to visit him in Mexico, but she wouldn't allow that either. Your father's been a bad boy. He didn't want his family, and now he can't have one.
The smell of urine was starting to get to Miles. Is it a good idea to be out here in this chill?
You mean me?
Miles gave a faint, helpless nod.
Dear Miles, you're so sweet to worry, she said, squeezing his hand again. But I'm past all that now. Even my doctors say so. I want to live my life now, not end it, especially with things looking up.
Meaning himself, Miles feared. We can go back, though, if you want.
They returned to the car, as Miles knew they would, by the path that took them past his mother's grave. There against her headstone sat an identical pot of marigolds, except these were flourishing, their yellow petals bright and healthy-looking.
It's as if even the flowers know they're marking the grave of a good person, Cindy said sadly. Do you think that's silly, Miles?
Yes, I do, he confessed. But I know what you mean.
Buster snorted awake, looking like a man who belonged in one of the Empire Gazette photographs among the missing persons. Miles dug the check he'd been holding onto since the 1st of September from under the cash register's drawer and handed it to Buster, who studied it for a moment and then asked, "Am I fired?" Miles poured him a cup of coffee and another for himself.
I was planning to put an ad in the paper tomorrow morning, he admitted. You were AWOL quite a while. What's wrong with your eye?
This was only the most obvious of the many questions Miles might have asked. Buster was pale, emaciated, filthy, and looked dispirited, embarrassed, and sick as a dog. Moreover, his eye was swollen shut and oozing pus at the corner. Miles felt certain that any number of stories were in the offing by way of explaining his sorry condition. He made a mental note not to let Buster and Max work the same shift until the former had a chance to put himself back together. The sight of either man would give anybody misgivings about the food, but the two of them together would send people running for the parking lot.
Spider bite,
Buster said, gingerly daubing pus onto the corner of a napkin. Miles had to look away. His stomach was never that great in the morning.
There's a weird-looking boy standing outside, Buster said. Claims he works here.
Miles went around the counter to the front door where John Voss stood motionless on the steps, hands in his pockets. Yesterday afternoon's warmth seemed a distant memory. This morning it was winter in the air. The boy glanced up when he heard the lock turn in the door, then quickly back at the ground.
He does work here, Miles told Buster, as he returned to the counter. He's our new busboy.
Looks more like a damn serial killer.
You're the one who looks like a serial killer, Miles pointed out. He's on the quiet side, but so far he seems like a pretty good worker.
Both men looked over at the door, aware that John Voss had not come in. Perhaps, Miles surmised, because he hadn't been specifically told to. Sure enough, when he returned to the door, John Voss was right where Miles had left him, apparently awaiting an invitation.
You can come in, Miles told him.
The boy nodded, scurrying inside with surprising speed. Miles followed him into the back room.
You can start on the pots, he said, pointing at the large stack left over from the night before. They'd been understaffed again, and Miles had said just to leave them soaking, knowing the new boy was coming in early. Besides, Sunday was a short day. The restaurant opened only for breakfast. Though so few showed up, it was hardly worth the effort. With Friday and Saturday nights doing so well, it made sense to close and give everyone a day off. That would also allow him to attend Sunday morning mass, which he missed. Most weeks, he found a way to slip out long enough to catch the 5:30 on Saturday afternoon. But for an old altar boy, that wasn't quite the same. Yesterday, thanks to his late afternoon cemetery tour with Cindy Whiting, he'd missed mass entirely, leaving him feeling slightly unmoored this morning. Recalling Horace's strange warning on Friday night, as well as Otto Meyer's gratitude for his having given the boy a job, Miles studied him as he filled the sink and began to work, trying to imagine what the rest of this strange boy's life would be like. He was off to such a poor start that, to Miles, he seemed destined to become the subject of a future query. Does anybody know the boy in this photograph? That is, if he ever made it into a photo. It was the Zach Minties who got into the newspapers. On the other hand, who knew? The boy might turn out to be the next Bill Gates. Congratulations, by the way, Miles said, when the boy stopped scrubbing, but didn't look up.
I heard you had a painting selected for the art show.
Tick two, he said, still without looking up, though Miles could see his eyes darting nervously, as if fearful that volunteering so much information all at once might have dire consequences. Out front again, Miles flipped the rows of bacon. He always cooked it about 3/4 in advance of actual orders, then crisped it to suit his customers. While his stomach was feeling better, the odd feeling of standing on railroad tracks awaiting an approaching train was still there, the result, perhaps, of another largely sleepless night. He and David had closed up at 10:30, and Miles, exhausted, had gone upstairs and fallen asleep with his clothes on, television remote in hand, before he could even turn the set on. He'd awakened with a start from a nightmare in which He'd been searching for Cindy Whiting's cane beneath the Empire Field bleachers, but instead he found Tick, curled up asleep among the hot dog wrappers and empty styrofoam cups. Except she wasn't asleep. He realized this in the instant before his violent twitch sent the television remote skittering under a pallet containing boxes of paper towels. His watch said it was midnight, too late to call. But before he could talk himself out of his panic, he'd already dialed his old telephone number. Janine answered on the first ring.
"Did Tick make it home okay?" he blurted.
"Miles?" she said, as if she had a long list of people she allowed to call her at this time of night, and he wasn't on it.
"Is Tick back?"
"Not yet."
"It's midnight, Janine."
"I know what time it is, Miles. Is something the matter?
Would you mind calling me when she gets home?"
"You didn't answer my question."
"It's stupid," he admitted.
In fact, the sound of his soon-to-be ex-wife's voice, even its cosmic annoyance, was reassuring.
"I was asleep. In this dream, she was hurt."
Her voice relented a little.
"I'm sure she's fine, Miles. Her deadline is midnight. She'll be home soon." "Call me anyway," he asked. "And tell Walt I'm sorry about phoning so late.
You want me to wake him up or tell him in the morning?" The annoyance had ratcheted back up a couple of notches, but not apparently at him.
"Morning would be fine."
"Good," she said. "A man his age needs his rest." What in the world was this about? Then again, Miles reminded himself, he didn't really want to know. And yet, "Is everything okay, Janine?"
"Everything's peachy, Miles, just peachy. Why do you ask?"
"Call me when she gets in, okay?"
"You don't want to talk to me, is what you're saying."
"Are you," he paused,
"drinking, Janine?"
"Maybe a little.
Is that all right with you?"
"It's none of my business."
"You got that right," she said. Then after a beat,
"I mentioned it to Walt about the house again. I told him I wanted to buy out your share as soon as we're married."
"What was his response to that?"
"You ever watch a cow chew a cud?"
"You don't have to marry him, you know."
"Yeah, well, I want to, okay?"
"Sure, I'm not saying you shouldn't, just that you don't have to."
"I know, Miles. As far as you're concerned, I can do anything I damn well please, including go to hell, right?"
Conversations like this one, Miles realized, were the price of poor impulse control.
"Janine, that Cindy Whiting you were with at the football game?"
"Yes."
"If you married her, it wouldn't matter about this shitty little house. You don't have the damn town. You could pay for Tick's college and move away and never have to see me again."
Unless Miles was mistaken, she was now quietly weeping, her hand over the phone.
"Janine," muffled silence for a long beat, then,
"they just pulled in, okay?"
"Janine, your daughter's safe. I'm looking out the window at her right now. Go back to sleep."
"Janine."
But she'd hung up.
"Anyhow, can I have today off?" Buster wondered, as if to suggest that he'd had an even worse night than Miles. Miles deposited the prepped bacon into a stainless steel tub.
"I insist," he said. "In fact, I really don't want you coming in until that eye quits draining."
"I bet I have to get the fucker lanced," Buster said morosely, as if life offered up little more than a string of such horrible necessities. "I don't know why I keep going up into the Allagash. People think there's nothing going on up there, but they're wrong. There's all kinds of shit happening, all of it bad."
Miles bladed most of the lake of bacon grease into the trough with the side of a spatula, then added some chopped onions to the grill.
"You have any idea how high the rate of alcoholism runs up in the county?"
Buster said urgently.
"Normally or when you're visiting?"
"Normally."
"Pretty bad?"
"Worse," Buster said, as if prepared for a low-ball estimate. "Of course, up there near the border, they don't share in the rest of the state's prosperity."
Miles turned around to study his fry cook for the merest trace of irony.
"I guess I could eat a couple strips of that bacon," Buster said. "Maybe an egg?"
Miles scrambled two of them and set them on a plate along with some bacon and the toast. Buster dug in with better appetite than Miles would have imagined possible for a man with yolk already seeping out of one eye.
"You shouldn't have waited for me," he said when he pushed his cleaned plate away. "You should have given my job to somebody else."
"I know that," Miles admitted.
"You're too soft-hearted," Buster continued. "People take advantage of you."
"I know that, too," Miles admitted, hoping to terminate the analysis. Outside, he glimpsed Charlene's rusted old Hyundai as it turned off Empire into the lot, and for the first time in more than 20 years, her proximity failed to cause Miles Roby's heart to leap, as if Buster's exhausted, pus-leaking defeatism had been subtly transmitted over the Formica counter and somehow entered Miles's own bloodstream. Buster had set his coffee cup down on the newspaper, which acted as an inky sponge, and by the time Miles moved the cup onto the counter, the ring it left had ruined his mother's face.
"You're a damn fool, is why,"
Buster said, suddenly angry. He stared as Miles blotted the newsprint with a napkin, and then, after a long beat, he began to cry.
"I'm sorry, Miles," he said after a minute.
Maybe he'd heard the back door open and close and knew that in another minute Charlene would join them. She was far too beautiful a woman to cry in front of.
"I don't know what come over me. I really don't."
"Go on home, Buster," Miles said, without looking up from the photo, where, though his mother was no longer recognizable, he'd spotted a detail that he hadn't noticed before. There was no doubt about it now. Something was approaching. The tracks he was standing on were vibrating with the force of it, yet he was powerless to move away as much as a step. He sensed, rather than saw, Buster slide off his stool and disappear, and he had no idea how many times Charlene, standing at his elbow, had to say his name before he was able to meet her alarmed, questioning eyes.
"Are you all right?" she wanted to know. "You look weird."
Had she gotten there a few seconds sooner, she'd have seen him put the tip of his index finger over the lower half of C.B. Whiting's bearded face. But even then she wouldn't have understood what it meant. That the face now staring back at him was not that of C.B. Whiting, as identified by the staff of the Empire Gazette, but rather that of Charlie Mayne.
Chapter 19. By the time the bus finally pulled into the Fairhaven terminal, the promise Miles had made to his mother earlier that morning, to say nothing about Charlie Mayne, was beginning to weigh on him. He hadn't imagined that a promise made in safety on a ferry boat docked in Vineyard Haven could grow as weighty as this one had in a matter of hours. In Woods Hole, they'd boarded a bus to Boston, where they'd changed to another heading north to Maine. In Portland, they'd changed again, this time to a bus whose destination was Fairhaven, which was literally the end of the line. Empire Falls itself, of course, had recently become one stop beyond the end of the line when bus service was suspended the year before, and there was talk now of closing the Fairhaven terminal, which consisted of a window at the rear of the smoke shop and a small designated parking area around back. Grace had parked the Dodge there when they left for Martha's Vineyard a week earlier, though that seemed much longer ago now. Neither she nor Miles was surprised to discover it missing upon their return. To Miles, it was as if they'd been away forever, so long that a car left unattended might simply dematerialize, like water in the bottom of a glass. To Grace, it meant that Max was out of jail. Though a short distance, Fairhaven to Empire Falls was a long-distance call, and Grace had to make several before she was able to reach someone willing to come fetch them. They waited in a coffee shop across the street, and since it was well past dinner time, Grace insisted that Miles eat something, even though he claimed he wasn't hungry. The fumes from all the buses, combined with the fact that he'd soon be seeing his father again,
had made him sick to his stomach. But when the hot dog came, it smelled good, and he ate the whole thing. Grace watching him sadly as she drank her coffee. When it came time to pay and Grace opened her billfold, Miles saw there was just enough to cover what they'd ordered. Unless his mother had any money squirreled away in another compartment, they'd made it back home, or almost home, with only loose change to spare. Which led Miles to wonder what his mother had planned to do if Charlie hadn't showed up and started paying for things. The woman who came to bring them back to Empire Falls was younger than Grace, and very homely, Miles thought, and she drove a car that was in even worse shape than their Dodge. Miles, of course, was relegated to the back seat with the luggage. The trunk wouldn't open, the woman said, and Miles couldn't help thinking how different everything had become in a single day. This time last night, he and his mother had been flying across the island in Charlie's slick, canary-yellow sports car after consuming a dinner that had cost, Miles had sneaked a look at the check, more than $50. Tonight, his hot dog had cost 35 cents, his mother's coffee a quarter, and even then, they'd barely been able to afford it. Maud, the young woman who'd picked them up at the station, talked pretty much the entire way to Empire Falls, catching Grace up on all that had happened. Once again, there was a rumor that the mill was going to be sold, this one fueled by the fact that C.B. Whiting had gone off on Thursday without telling anyone where, causing people to speculate that he'd gone to Atlanta or some other place down south to put the finishing touches on the sale. If true, it meant that some of them wouldn't have jobs at the shirt factory much longer, especially those like Grace and Maud, who worked in the office. New management would bring in their own people for those positions, and it was common knowledge that Southerners worked for even less than Mainers. The fledgling union was already talking strategy, and Max, she added, her voice low so Miles wouldn't overhear, was again a free man. He'd been over to the mill looking for Grace earlier in the week. Maud seemed not to notice Grace's silence in response to all of this, and they were nearly to Empire Falls before it occurred to the young woman to inquire how their vacation had been. "What's it like being on an island?" she wanted to know, reminding Miles that until a week ago he'd believed islands to be strips of land somehow floating on the water that surrounded them. That's what they looked like on maps. And before arriving on Martha's Vineyard, he'd wondered if the ground beneath your feet would feel as solid as it did on real land. If everyone on an island were to move to one side, would it tip over? He knew that couldn't be possible. But still, he'd been glad to see just how solid everything felt when they stepped off the ferry. It was returning home, he now understood, that made everything so tippy. His father wasn't home when Miles and his mother got there, and neither was the Dodge, but there was a note attached to the refrigerator with a magnet. He'd gone to paint a house in Castine and would be back by the end of the week. Miles located the crumpled note in the trash where Grace had tossed it, smoothed it out, and read it start to finish, surprised that it said pretty much what his mother had said it did, no more, no less. It seemed to Miles that a man who'd sat in jail for a week while his wife and son vacationed on Martha's Vineyard would have come out with more to say. With so much time to think, he might have grown sorrowful or angry or determined or reformed. His father had apparently rejected all of these options and come out of jail determined to paint somebody's house in Castine. Miles himself was not alluded to in the note. A relief, since it had occurred to him that Max might regard him as his mother's accomplice. Until a few days ago, Miles had not suspected the existence of men like Charlie Maine, who might have given a chance steal another man's wife. And judging from the note, his father still hadn't tumbled to that possibility either. Or if he had, he didn't blame Miles for not being up to the task of protecting his mother's virtue. Once back in Empire Falls, Miles and Grace didn't really need either Max or the Dodge. Miles could bike to baseball practice or wherever else he needed to go, and she walked to work in the morning. Like most of the women in the main office,
She brown-bagged her lunch to save both money and time. If you ate a quick sandwich at your desk, you could go home at 4:30 instead of 5. C.B. Whiting, the mill's owner, still hadn't returned on Monday. So every evening that week, the phone rang and rang. Girls from the office wanting to know if Grace, who was generally acknowledged to be first among equals at the main office, had heard anything new. By Friday, Max had not returned as promised, and it became clear to Miles that Grace was falling into a deep depression. The reason, he felt certain, had little to do with the possibility that she might lose her job, and even less with her husband's continued absence. She was thinking, Miles could tell, about Charlie Maine and his promise that everything would work out. Each time the phone rang in the evening, Grace leapt for it, her face bright with hope, only to collapse when she recognized the voice of Maud or another of the office girls, flush with another rumor. According to one, C.B. Whiting had returned at last, but immediately left again. Twice, Miles observed his mother making phone calls herself, then quickly hanging up. On Monday of the second week, old Honus Whiting, C.B.'s father, showed up unexpectedly and called a general meeting of all the mill's workers, announcing that for the immediate future, he himself would again be in charge of Empire Manufacturing. He knew there had been a lot of speculation that the mill was being sold, but he wanted everyone to know that the rumors were untrue. On the contrary, another Whiting mill was being opened in Mexico, and C.B. would be temporarily relocating there to get the new operation up and running. Francine Whiting, C.B.'s wife, who recently had learned she was pregnant, would join her husband in Mexico next month, once suitable accommodations could be made ready, and she would winter there, returning in the spring to have the baby, which everyone hoped would be a male heir to guide Whiting Enterprises International into the next century. The employees of all three mills listened to what the old man had to say, and when he was finished, they went back to work. Not much of what they'd heard sounded anything like the truth. That evening, Miles returned late from baseball practice and found his mother sobbing on the bed in the room she shared with her husband, at least when Max was around to share it. And Miles immediately suspected she'd gotten the phone call she'd been waiting for from Charlie Maine. She called in sick the next day, and the next. Morning, she was sicker than she'd been on Martha's Vineyard, and evenings, she could barely be coaxed out of the bedroom long enough to fix something for supper. By the end of the week, Miles was truly alarmed. Grace had such a wild, desperate look in her eyes that he began to hope for his father's return, something he'd been dreading because of all the questions that would inevitably get asked. Worse than needing to keep all the secrets he felt entrusted with was the knowledge that his father would want answers to other questions as well. Answers Miles himself did not possess. But day after day, neither Max nor the Dodge turned up. On Saturday afternoon of the third week, the door to his parents' bedroom opened, and Grace appeared in a dark dress that Miles hadn't seen her wear since the funeral of a neighbor who'd been killed on the swing shift at Empire Paper last spring. She wore no jewelry or makeup, but she'd done up her hair and would have looked nice, Miles thought, if she hadn't lost so much weight. An entirely different sort of nice from the nice way she'd looked in her white summer dress on the island when all the men had turned to stare, but nice still. When she announced that it had been more than a month since either of them had been to confession, she met Miles's eye meaningfully. Though it was a sunny afternoon in late August, several nights during the week had been chilly, and Miles noticed during their silent walk to St. Catherine's that a few of the uppermost leaves on the elms had already begun to turn. Grace didn't seem to notice this or anything else. She looked like a woman marching to her own execution. She'd timed their arrival, so they would be the last of the afternoon's penitents. Miles, she insisted, should enter the confessional first, and when he finished, say his penance quickly and wait for her outside. As always, they hoped for the new young priest, but as luck would have it, when Miles slid onto the kneeler inside the dark confessional and the velvet curtain was pulled back on the other side of the latticework, Father Tom's dark silhouette was revealed, and the older priest's stern voice urged him to recount his sins so that they might be forgiven. Miles had received his first communion the year before, so of course he knew that to conceal one mortal sin was to commit yet another. Since returning from Martha's Vineyard, he'd grown certain that he, not just his mother, had somehow sinned there, though he wasn't sure what sort of sin it was or how to explain it to the man on the other side of the lattice. He knew he'd betrayed his father by promising to keep his mother's secret, just as he was certain that if he broke that promise, he would be betraying her. In either case, it was a sin to try to keep a secret from God, who already knew. Why exactly it was necessary to confess what God already knew had been explained in religious instruction by the very man who now sat on the other side of the lattice. But the delicate logic of it was confusing to Miles at the time and eluded him entirely now. He had come to confession armed with a list of sins he hadn't committed, sins he hoped were equal in magnitude to whatever he was concealing, and he further hoped God would understand that his reticence about coming clean didn't stem from any desire to make himself look good. Father Tom listened to his litany of substitute sins and offered penance with the air of a man who is convinced not so much of the truth of what he's just heard as of the general human depravity in which such behavior has its origins. At the altar railing, Miles knelt and said his Our Fathers and Hail Marys, and was about to leave when he heard the confessional door open and saw his mother following Father Tom into the sacristy. He sat on the steps outside for half an hour, and when his mother finally appeared, her face was ashen. He guided her home as you might lead a blind woman, and when they arrived, she went directly into the bedroom and closed the door behind her. The next morning, Sunday, they went to Mass, but during the sermon, Grace became ill, and after instructing Miles to stay where he was, she stumbled down the side aisle, one hand over her mouth, and out the side door. Perhaps anticipating this, she had wanted to sit nearer the rear of the church than was their custom, but even so, people turned to watch her stagger out, and it seemed to Miles that Father Tom made matters worse by pausing in his sermon until the church door swung shut behind her. There was an Esso station a block up the street, and Miles suspected his mother had gone there to be sick. But when communion began, she still had not returned. Miles waited, then joined the very end of the line, though painfully aware that he should not receive the host. He'd lied in confession yesterday, and knew better than to invite God into his impure body. On the other hand, since he had gone to confession, it would seem strange if he didn't take communion. So he received the wafer on a tongue so dry with guilt and shame that instead of dissolving, it remained there like a scrap of thin cotton cloth. He was still trying to swallow the host when he felt his mother slide back into the pew next to him, looking pale and weak. When she took his hand and squeezed hard, it seemed that what she was trying to convey to him was exactly what he feared most, that she was going to die as a result of what she'd done on Martha's Vineyard. She'd caught something there and brought the illness home with her. Going to confession yesterday hadn't made her better, so Miles wondered if she, too, had lied to the priest, if at the moment she'd realized it was Father Tom who knew her instead of the younger priest, she decided to keep her secret. Father Tom must have suspected as much and made her go with him into the sacristy, but even there she must have refused to tell him about Charlie Maine. Miles was aware that this scenario was problematic. For one thing, his mother had gotten sick days before Charlie Maine showed up, but he reasoned that maybe she'd made up her mind in advance to do whatever they'd done, and that was where the sin had begun, in the wickedness of a thought, as he'd learned in religious instruction. Maybe getting sick had been a warning from God that she'd chosen to ignore. This, then, was the price of her short-lived happiness. When they returned home from Mass, Miles half expected his mother to retire to the bedroom, but instead, she told him she had to go out.
When he asked her where she was going, she said only that there was something she had to do. Miles knew it was wrong, but he followed her. Since on Sunday there were few people on the street, Miles was careful lest she turn around suddenly and catch him. But it soon became clear that she was too preoccupied to notice anything. When she got to the shirt factory, Miles thought for a moment that this was her destination and that she intended to go inside. But after pausing there for a minute, she continued on. At the iron bridge, to his surprise, she turned left onto the pedestrian walkway, and there was no way he could follow without making his presence known. When Grace was halfway across, the truth came to him. She intended to jump. He was so sure of it that when she didn't, when she walked right past the place where you'd jump if you were going to, Miles still couldn't banish the idea. Because what other explanation could there be? After all, there was little on the other side of the river but the country club and two or three houses owned by rich people. On the sloping lawn of one of these, the nearest, was a gazebo, where a solitary woman sat staring out across the falls. She was too far away from Miles to be sure, of course, but she seemed to be tracking his mother's progress across the bridge. Perhaps seeing her sitting there had prevented Grace from jumping. Maybe she now intended to jump on the way back. Miles waited a few minutes to see if his mother, once she reached the far side, would turn back. But she didn't. And by the time he finally left his post at the town side of the bridge, it seemed that the woman in the gazebo was staring at him. On Labor Day, without warning, Max returned. Miles, out enjoying the last day of his summer vacation, came home at noon for lunch and found the Dodge parked outside, and Max, shirtless and berry brown from a summer's worth of painting people's windows shut, sitting at the kitchen table, reading the Empire Gazette, as if hoping to find in it news of what Miles and his mother had been up to during his absence. When Miles walked in, his father finished the paragraph he was reading, then looked up, and seeing his son, grinned. Miles could see that he was missing a couple teeth. "What happened?" he asked, immediately frightened. "What, this?" Max said, sticking his tongue through the new gap. "It's nothing. I just had a little difference of opinion with a guy, is all. He doesn't know it yet, but he's going to pay me about $500 per tooth." Miles nodded, not so much reassured by his father's explanation as by his presence. Having dreaded Max's return, he immediately felt how good it was to have him home. His father had only a couple of speeds, which made him predictable, and Miles was ready for things to be predictable again, even if they were predictably odd. Max might not be like other men, but he was always like himself. Other men, for instance, might get upset over minor car accidents, whereas Max saw fender benders as opportunities. If somebody backed into him in a parking lot, which people did with such regularity as to raise suspicions that Max purposely put himself in harm's way, Max took his damaged car to a mechanic he depended upon for an inflated estimate. Then he'd offer to settle the matter for half the estimate in cash, in return for which consideration nobody's insurance company needed to be involved, meaning the other drivers, since Max himself was never insured. Once the money was in his pocket, he was disinclined to squander it by fixing up the car. Oh, he might replace a broken headlight if state law required it, and if a side panel was badly dented, he'd pound it out himself, though the results were generally more grotesque than the original dent. The Dodge had been repaired so many times that it resembled something built from scrap on a junk heap. Miles had little doubt that his father would realize his dental windfall, just as he knew no dentist was likely to see a penny. What Miles couldn't know, of course, was that he was witnessing the first stage in the systematic demolition of his father's body, that by the time Max Roby turned 70, he'd look like a 65 Dodge Dart that had been totaled on several different occasions. At the moment, he had to admit, his father looked the picture of health, his body lean and tanned,
and he couldn't help comparing his sturdy appearance with that of Charlie Mayne, who'd looked so pale and concave on the beach. And he couldn't help speculating about what would have happened if Max had gotten out of jail in time to track them down on Martha's Vineyard and found them eating caviar out of a picnic basket on the beach. He tried to imagine a fight between his father and Charlie Mayne, but no picture would form. Charlie Mayne was older and clearly no pugilist. Max was tough and durable. But his specialty, Miles was beginning to understand, was not in punching people, but in getting them to punch him, which he was pretty certain Charlie Mayne would never do. More likely, Max would simply have just invited himself to join them, saying, "I like caviar too, you know." In this dramatic scenario, if anybody ended up throwing a punch, it probably would have been Grace. "Where's Mom?" it occurred to him to ask, since the house didn't feel like she was in it. "Over at church," she said, Max told him. "She left you a sandwich in the fridge." "She goes every morning now," Miles said, which was true. Since returning from her journey across the river, she'd been to Mass every day, and moreover, she'd signed Miles up to be an altar boy once school started. Max grunted. "She must be feeling guilty about something," he ventured, studying his son. To avoid being stared at, Miles went over to the refrigerator and pretended to look for the sandwich, to put a door between his father and his burning cheeks. Slowly, he went about pouring himself a glass of milk and finally brought it to the table with his sandwich. "I heard you made a good catch," his father said, causing Miles to wonder whether he'd been told by Grace or by Coach LaSalle. For his father to allude to the incident now, so long after it had happened, felt weird. It had been a month since he'd put his mitt in the way of that line drive, and it seemed even longer, almost as if it had happened to some other boy. "Mom's been real sick," he heard himself announce. His father had gone back to reading the paper and didn't look up. Miles was about to tell him again when he said, "They always are at this stage." Miles considered whether to ask, who did he mean by they? At what stage? Noticing this silence, Max lowered the paper again, grinning, his gap-toothed smile no less disconcerting this time, though Miles was more prepared for it.
"She didn't tell you?"
"Tell me what?"
"You're gonna have a baby brother, is what."
When his father lifted the newspaper again, Miles ate the entire sandwich and drained the glass of milk without speaking. It took that long for the world to rearrange itself, for the facts to realign, for them to convey a new understanding of the way of things. The world, he now understood, was a physical, not a moral order. Nobody got sick and died as a consequence of sinning. He'd been suspecting as much, but now saw it clearly and realized that part of him had known it all along. People got sick because of viruses and bacteria and children, things like that, not as a result of islands or men like Charlie Mayne. What Miles took from this knowledge was mostly relief, and when he spoke, he was aware of something new either in or behind his voice, a new attitude, sort of. "You don't know that," he told his father.
"I don't, huh?" Max said, trading sports for the funnies.
"It could be a baby sister." His father chuckled, probably at peanuts.
"Mostly boys in our family."
"Then we're due for a girl," Miles said.
"That's not how it works. It's not like flipping a coin."
"What's it like then?" It seemed to Miles that it was exactly like flipping a coin, and he didn't see any reason to let his father skate on such dubious logic just because he was a grown-up. Max studied him, grinning again, though Miles wished he wouldn't.
"It's more like rolling dice," he explained, "except they don't have numbers. There's six sides to a cube, right? In our family, boy is written on about five sides of the cube. Girl is only written on one. So if you had to bet with your own money, which would you bet on?"
Miles did some calculations. After a minute, he said, "How many kids does Uncle Pete have?" His father's older brother had moved out west, to Phoenix, Arizona, 2 decades earlier.
4, said his father. All boys.
Miles nodded.
And you've got me.
You're a boy, too, last time I looked.
That's 5 in a row, Miles pointed out. Outside, footsteps sounded on the back porch. Grace returning from church. Both Miles and his father glanced up at the kitchen window when she passed. This week, her bouts of morning sickness had been less severe, and while she wasn't looking as radiantly beautiful as she had on Martha's Vineyard, neither did she appear as frightened and despairing as when they'd first returned.
Girl was on the 6th side, right?
Max considered this while Grace, who'd taken an umbrella with her just to be safe, hung it up in the outside hall.
You're becoming a regular pain in the ass, you know that?
They were both grinning now, and it occurred to Miles that the strange emotion he was feeling might be pride, though he wasn't positive whether he was proud of himself or proud of his father. He was pretty sure that becoming a pain in Max's ass was an acknowledgement of some sort, maybe even of fondness. When Grace came in from the hall, she seemed to intuit that father and son were sharing something important, because she sat down between them and reached to put a hand on both of theirs. And for a long moment, nobody said anything. It was the first time since they'd returned from Martha's Vineyard that Miles felt that maybe things would be okay, that they would return to normal, or at least what was normal for them. If he felt any regret, it was that Max would never get to see Grace in that white dress, since she donated it to Goodwill earlier in the week. Chapter 20. The housekeeper at St. Cat's, Mrs. Irene Walsh, was finishing up the pots and pans from the Sunday dinner it hadn't even been worth her while to cook. Father Mark, guilty about having eaten so little and feeling the need of a little human companionship, even in the gruff form of Mrs. Walsh, had offered to help clean up, but she'd rebuffed him. He'd just make more work for her by putting things away where they didn't belong, and tomorrow she wouldn't be able to find a thing. She could tell she'd hurt his feelings, which was fine with her. Mrs. Walsh was not an unkind woman, but she harbored an essentially medieval worldview. Her father had been an army man with a theological bent, and from him she'd learned all about the great chain of being, which, as explained by her father, was not unlike the military's chain of command. God was at the top, and below him his angels, ranked according to their angelic social class, then the Pope, his cardinals, bishops, priests, and so on. Mrs. Walsh was comforted by the notion that being a housekeeper to 2 priests was no closer to the bottom of the chain, occupied by rocks and other inanimate objects, than it was distant from the top. Keeping men of God clean and well-fed was honorable, if not exalted, work, and if others were chosen by God for more exalted work, then there must have been good reasons. To aspire to that which was beyond one's designated station in life was a sin, she believed. And in the end, all the strivers and the enviers would come to know the truth, that up and down the great chain there was but one duty, and that was to do God's will. A priest's duty was to be the best priest he could be, just as a housekeeper's was to be the best housekeeper. Just as annoying as the ones who were always striving to be above their stations in life, to Mrs. Walsh's way of thinking, were the falsely humble fools like Father Mark, who was always slumming in her kitchen, wanting in his ignorance to help out, grabbing dishcloths to wipe down countertops, encouraging her to go home before her work was completed. Poor discipline was what it amounted to, and her father would have agreed. Mrs. Walsh had adored her father, who nonetheless never paid her much mind. A military man, he devoted most of his time to lecturing his sons, whose temperaments were decidedly unmilitary. The more he stressed discipline, the wilder they became, and he died believing that no one had heard a single word he'd said, which was not true. His daughter had been listening. Mrs. Walsh believed, as he had, that society did well to honor distinctions,
and she regretted that so many people in today's world seemed intent on blurring them. The young ones, like Father Mark, were the worst. They put great store in kindness, which was all well and good, but old Father Tom, gone balmy as a magpie, was still more priestly than all the young ones put together, and he'd never once in all the years she'd worked for him felt compelled to lay a hand on a single one of her pots.
"I think that's Mr. Roby who just pulled in,"
Mrs. Walsh observed from where she stood at her sink.
"How about his father? Is Max with him?"
"Just Mr. Miles, and all he's doing is sitting there."
In the kitchen doorway, Father Mark smiled, his first of the day. He could guess what his friend was doing. He was looking up at the unpainted steeple, wondering what cruel code embedded in his genes prevented him from climbing ladders like normal human beings.
"Well, you've been waiting for him," the housekeeper said. "Are you going to tell him?"
"Ah, Mrs. Walsh," Father Mark wanted to say, "there is much to learn from you." She was no great thinker, Mrs. Walsh, but she did like to get things resolved, and you had to admire that. Find out, do it, don't turn it around in your hand to examine its many facets. The problem with the contemplative life was that there was no end to contemplation, no fixed time limit after which thought had to be transformed into action. Contemplation was like sitting on a committee that seldom made recommendations and was ignored when it did, a committee that lacked even the authority to disband. Mrs. Walsh was right. The present circumstance needed to be dealt with. And what's more, it needed to be dealt with by Father Mark, who'd wasted too much time already. The title of the feverish sermon he'd given at the early Mass that morning had been "When God Retreats." He had composed it partly in the car last night on the way home from the coast, and partly during a sleepless night, and partly in the pulpit as he delivered it. It had not gone as badly as he feared it might, and his intention had been to repeat "When God Retreats" at the late Mass. But when he returned to the rectory between services, he discovered that Father Tom was gone. Actually, Mrs. Walsh had discovered the old priest's disappearance when she arrived shortly after 8:30, by which time Father Tom was usually up and anxious to be fed. On Sundays, Mrs. Walsh made him French toast. Then, after the old man's chin began to glisten with maple syrup, she set about preparing the noon meal for the two of them, usually a ham or a roast chicken or, as today, a New England pot roast, a task made no easier by having a sticky, senile priest underfoot. True, she preferred the crazy old priest to the sane young one, but Father Tom did bear more or less constant watching, especially when Father Mark wasn't around. That was one thing the young priest was good for, she had to admit. On Sundays, knowing the other one was across the lawn giving his lame sermons, Father Tom could get mischievous. One morning, when he came into her kitchen, Mrs. Walsh had caught a glimpse of him out of the corner of her eye without noticing anything amiss. When she served him his French toast, she did think something was odd about the way he regarded her, as if he was relishing some joke that had escaped her. But Mrs. Walsh found this highly unlikely, she herself being a perfectly sane 53-year-old married woman and the old father being pretty much completely batshit. Still, since there was nothing in the world Mrs. Walsh despised more than a joke she might be the butt of, she stopped dressing her chicken to eyeball him, sitting there at the table. He was dressed in a freshly laundered standard priest-issue short-sleeve black shirt with a starched white collar, and his usually unruly white hair had been brushed flat. She even noticed that his shoes had been spit-shined, and his black linen socks were a match. If a joke was hidden anywhere on Father Tom's person, she couldn't locate it, so she returned to cramming handfuls of stuffing into her roasting chicken. Only when the old father rose from the table and brought his plate over to the drain board, for him an uncharacteristically helpful gesture, did she see that he was wearing no trousers. So today, when she'd entered the rectory and the old father wasn't in immediate evidence, she went looking for him, suspicious that more mischief was afoot. His bedroom door was shut, and when Mrs. Walsh knocked, calling his name and demanding that he open up or else she'd fetch the young one. She half expected a bare-assed, shriveled-dicked old clergyman to open the door and grin at her. While Mrs. Walsh did not look forward to this prospect, neither did it frighten her. At 53, she was through with the foolishness of men's genitals. In fact, it had been many years since she had cared what hairy things dangled between their pale, scrawny legs. She now considered the fact that she had ever cared a kind of temporary lunacy, and was thankful that her madness had been short-lived, not terribly virulent, and ultimately cured by marriage, as God intended. The door remained closed to her threats, which left Mrs. Walsh no alternative but to enter without invitation. The door was unlocked and revealed, when she pushed it open, an empty room. Mrs. Walsh made sure it was empty, getting down on her hands and knees, a maneuver she would have preferred not to perform on her inflamed joints, to look under the bed. Her thought was that an aging priest, balmy enough to appear pantless in her kitchen, might just be playing hide-and-seek. But no one was under the bed, and there was no place else in the Spartan quarters large enough to conceal a child, much less a full-grown man with the mind of a child. Neither did the old priest seem to be anywhere else in the rectory. Mrs. Walsh checked every room and every closet in the house, and even took a flashlight down into the cellar, a damp, horrid place that still had coal bins and plenty of dark corners for a demented old priest to hide in. She had just about satisfied herself that Father Tom had risen early and defied orders by going out for a walk, or perhaps sneaked over to the church and hidden in the confessional so he could spy on the young one and listen in on whatever sort of liberal nonsense he was spouting from the pulpit, when something occurred to her, and she hurried back upstairs to his room. He still wasn't there, but more to the point, his bed did not appear to have been slept in. Of course, it was possible he'd made it after getting up, as he'd done all his life until his mind began to go, but now he mostly forgot. Yesterday, Saturday, had been Mrs. Walsh's day to change the bedding for both fathers, and when she pulled back the cover and examined the sheets beneath, they felt and smelled freshly of Clorox, not so much as a hint of stale, flatulent old clergyman. But it wasn't the bed that provided the real clue. It was the wastebasket, and Mrs. Walsh nearly walked right by it without noticing. The basket she'd emptied just yesterday was now nearly full again, and what it was nearly full of was the small, mint-green envelopes used by parishioners to conceal from other parishioners just how niggardly their weekly offerings were. Every last envelope, no doubt collected from Saturday evening's 5:30 Mass, had been torn open and then tossed into the wastebasket. Also within the metal cylinder were checks that had been enclosed in the envelopes. What Mrs. Walsh registered immediately was the complete absence of legal tender. When the young one came loping across the lawn after early Mass, Mrs. Walsh was waiting for him, arms folded across her matronly bosom. Where another woman might have been thrown into a tizzy by this point, Mrs. Walsh had remained